said we were going to have a talk on Buddhism, so it's not exactly a talk, and it's not exactly on Buddhism. I was thinking, well, in a way you could say that the best way to find out about Buddhism is to meet a Buddhist. And so we're going to meet a Buddhist tonight in the person of Jnanavacha. So I'm going to sort of interview Jnanavacha, really, and he's going to just share some of his experience of Buddhist life and work with us. So I particularly wanted to have Jnanavacha. Jnanavacha, for those of you who don't know, is the chairman of the London Buddhist Centre. He's been the chairman for about 5 years?
Three.
Seems like five. And he's one of our main teachers here at the London Buddhist Centre. He teaches regularly this Monday night class, as well as our Wednesday class, as well as many other talks and courses and so on. So I thought, just to warm us up, we could just... well, in a way, I was thinking, well, you haven't always been chairman. At one point, you presumably came along to a class just like this. And I was going to ask you, like, did you ever, when you came along to this class, did you ever imagine you'd be chairman of the Buddhist Centre?
I can remember coming along to a class a little like this one, but it was on a Tuesday night. Our regulars night was on a Tuesday night. And feeling like I was the only person in the room that wasn't a Buddhist. I was the only person in the room that didn't have a regular meditation practice, that still went out drinking with my friends most nights of the week, or certainly at weekends. And feeling slightly fraudulent, like I was somehow, you know, not the man that the Buddhist Centre thought that I was. And I can remember saying that to Ratnagosha. He said to me, Ratnagosha was the current chairman when I started coming along in the early 90s. And he said to me, oh, I've not seen you around for a while, and I've not been to the Buddhist Centre for a while. And apparently I said to him, well, I don't feel sort of worthy of being here, because I haven't been practicing as I should have done, as it were, as I'd like to have done. So certainly I didn't, I mean, when I saw people becoming mitras, I thought, my goodness, you know, they're very, very dedicated practitioners, and no way could I become a mitra. Until somebody who was a friend, or becoming a friend of mine, said to me, when are you going to become a mitra then? And I thought, who, me, as it were? and it was sort of... Actually, that's been sort of my experience all along, including becoming chairman, that I've sort of found myself in situations that I didn't expect, and sort of decided to go with it.
And that's interesting. I'm interested that it was a friend of yours that said that. Has that been the way all along?
It has, actually. I think I've responded to friends of mine. It was Paramabandhu who asked me to become chair, or asked me to consider becoming a chairman. And he's a very, very good friend of mine. And he was the chairman before me and wanted to step down. And, well, I can remember him taking me out to lunch. I've just been on this... I've been supporting the men's ordination retreat, which is a four-month retreat in Spain. And I'd come back, and he said, why don't we go out to lunch, Jnanavacha? And I thought, great. Paramabandhu's a consultant psychiatrist, and so when we go out to lunch, he buys me lunch. and I thought, great, I've been sort of eating, you know, sort of healthy food, but, you know, it'd be nice to have some unhealthy food with Paramabandhu. And we went out to lunch, and it was all very well and nice, and then he said, look, I'd like to stand down as being from being chairman, and would you consider it? And my heart really did drop, sank. And I just said, no. No, no, you mustn't stand down, and no, I mustn't do it. But it was only because it was a friend asking me that I felt, in a way, sort of impelled to respond. Mm. I mean, there are other factors, mm. of course, involved. But I think I have responded mm. to friends, mm. yeah.
So what do you mean by that when you say you're entitled to respond? You just sort of...
Well, yeah. I mean, I think by temperament, mm. I'm quite a lazy man. And would rather avoid difficult situations or any sort of difficulty, any sort of responsibility. And I like an easy life, as friends of mine who know me. And I'm quite happy to just sit around having coffee and chats with people. But I don't particularly relish taking on things. At the same time, I kind of know that if I did just sit around, drink coffee all day, I wouldn't be fulfilled. Mm. I might be sort of, I might enjoy it for a while, but I'd also start to feel like I wasn't really living the life that I want to live somewhere. So there's a compulsion within me to try and do more than my natural instincts often want to let me do. Then there's a sense of wanting to really give something back. Mm. I feel I've got a huge amount. I mean, I can't put into words how much I feel I've received from Bhante Sangharakshita, from many, many order members, from the Buddhist Centre here. My life's been completely transformed. And I can't help but then want to give something back, even though a large part of me wants to just sit around all day. Again, there's a compulsion to give something back. And when I do, or to the extent I can, I feel a better man, a better, more fulfilled human being. And then there's responding to people that I feel grateful to. So Paramabandhu, Maitribandhu are both men who have helped me. Ratnagosha, Subhuti, etc. And they're doing the work of the centre, so when they say, will you help, it's there's another sort of compulsion to rise to that. So I think that's what I mean by other sort of instincts of being impelled.
Thanks for offering that up. And interesting, you talked about friendship, because I wanted to as well ask you particularly about some of those friendships you mentioned, because I know you live upstairs in one of our men's communities, and I think there's about, seven, eight, nine of
you? There's nine of us at the moment.
Okay, and some of those people you must have lived with for...
16, 17 years.
So that's Maitribandhu, Paramabandhu,
and Maitri Raja.
So that's a long time
to
live together.
It's a long time to live with somebody. It's a long time. And for some of that time, like with Maitri Raja, I've shared a room. I don't share at the moment, but I've shared a sort of bunk bed for many years with, you know, Maitri Raja and some other people. So you get to know somebody very intimately. I was always on the bottom bunk. Different bunk. You still get to know them. So yes, I feel very, very fortunate in that sort of close friendship. It's not something that I anticipated, interestingly enough. I mean, when I moved into a community, I moved in because I wanted to deepen my practice of Buddhism, and I wanted to live with other Buddhists. But I don't think I was very conscious that what that would mean is deepening relationships and friendships. Friendships that would become the most important relationships in my life. I don't think I sort of conceived of it in those terms. I thought we'd meditate together and we'd study Buddhism together, and that would be what made the difference. But actually what's far and away been the most important thing is those friendships. And I think, I mean, I never felt lacking in friendship, so I don't even think I kind of thought there was more to be had, as it were. I've sort of had good friends for as long as I can remember, but there's a difference when you're trying to live and work with people who are following the same ideals. There's a difference that seems to go beyond temperament, for example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the four of us who have lived together upstairs for 17 years, Maitreya Bandhu, Maitreya Raja, Paramabandhu, myself, temperamentally we're very, very, very different people. Mm. And I don't think in any other situation would the four of us have become friends in the way that we have. But it feels like, in a way, friends feels too small a word. It feels like they're people that I'm sharing my life and my work with. Yeah. Well, and with you, for example.
Yeah.
And that feels very satisfying.
Mm. And what, because I was going to ask you, I mean, maybe you've half answered, but is it, like, what's the secret of that friendship? Like, is it, has it just naturally evolved, or do you sort of actively work at it together?
Lots of coffee and cake, and seems of Paramabandhu taking us out to lunch helps. I think there's something about having having a common project that's really helped.
Yeah.
So the four of us have we're all involved in the work of the centre, and the community itself. I think we see it as a project, not just as a place to live, but as a place to help others enter into, as a place of practice and of friendship. So I think having a common project has been really, really important. So it's not just that we're trying to hang out, because if that's all there was to the friendship, then you'd, I don't know, you'd do it sometimes and not if you didn't feel like it. Whereas a common project feels like a deeper reason to be together.
Yeah.
So that's really, really helped. I think, also, I've just felt a lot of, well, one of the benefits of friendship is that you can be completely yourself. Mm. You can be completely yourself and be allowed to be yourself. In fact, to be encouraged to be myself. And I've had a lot of that sort of encouragement. And I don't think that's very common in normal friendships, normal relationships. Maybe it is for some people. But I think it's particularly true in the Sangha. And I've been particularly blessed by having people who have just said no, or not even no, it's just encouraged me to be myself. More myself. And you know, it's great when you can completely be open with somebody. So there's no aspect of my life that I'm not able to talk about or share with some of those people.
That's quite something, isn't
it?
And I was thinking, because I've known you, I've been here for about 5 years and worked particularly closely with you and Maitreya Bandhu, and thinking about it, I've never seen you, you know, exchange a cross or harsh word with each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the opposite, really. Yeah. Like, I notice that you'll often, you know, you're very playful with each other and you rejoice in each other. And also you know each other well enough to kind of almost speak for the other in a positive way. Like, if I say to Nyanavaja, could you do this talk? You say, oh no, I can't do it that night, but Maitreya Bandhu will do it, you know. With, and you know, or vice versa. Or vice
versa.
Yes. But it's quite something, isn't it, to be able to speak to your friend like that. But have there been any difficulties in all about that time?
I wouldn't say that there have, actually. And I can't recall kind of difficulties. At all, between not me and Maitreya Bandhu, but also that goes for Paramabandhu and Maitreya Raja as well. With Maitreya Raja, we used to have to negotiate the space. It was quite a small room. Fortunately, he's a very, very patient, tolerant, easygoing man. And for all the years that we shared a room, it was, in my mind, definitely my room. And had he not been so easygoing, there might have been difficulties, but there weren't.
It is amazing, though, even though we're laughing, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's 16 years without
a
corner. Okay, so I'm going to kind of move on to another arena. So I know that today, because I've talked to you earlier, that you've been at your, what was your mum's house? It's coming up to the year's anniversary of your mum's death, isn't it?
Next week.
And then today you've just been doing the last of clearing her house with your sister. And, well, I know from talking to you individually that that's been a, you know, very huge experience for you, the death of your mum. And I just wondered if you'd share what that's been. It's been a very meaningful experience for you, hasn't it?
I'd like to do that. I'd like to try.
Yeah.
I guess I feel I need to sort of give a little bit of background to introduce my mum. Because she had a spiritual practice of her own. She'd been meditating for over 30 years. And she lived on her own. My father had died when I was quite young. And so she was very, very encouraging of me having a spiritual practice and a spiritual life. She used to practice with... her guru was Osho. So it wasn't quite Buddhist, but it had lots of overlaps with Buddhism. And so we had this sort of mother-son relationship with its ups and downs at times, in that, you know, I would get very irritated at times with her just being her. But then we also had a spiritual... Well, we could talk about the Dharma together. Mm. And that felt very, very special. Very, very special. It's like we could meet on another level at times. And she died very, very well. She was sort of ready to die. She wasn't particularly ill, but life had... She'd lived a long time, at least in terms of what she had to endure. And her body was a painful experience, and had been for, in a way, most of her life. There were lots and lots of painful, debilitating conditions that she had to endure. And what she was worried about was becoming dependent on other people and becoming a burden, either to other people, myself or my sister. And she didn't do that. I saw her about a week, no, 10 days before she died, and then I went on a solitary retreat, so she died while I was away. And the last thing that she'd said to me, and she was fine when she was speaking, was she was talking about the house and how, well, she was going to leave us the house. Well, we knew that already, but she was saying, look, do this with the house. She was saying she wanted to tidy up her affairs in her bank account, and she was going to do that. And she just said, oh, look, I really hope you have a great time, and I hope I can die without ever becoming a burden to you. And that was her sort of farewell to me. And then she did. She just sort of died very suddenly and without pain. And so my immediate kind of... There was shock, but there was also a lot of joy. More than joy, actually. I felt a huge delight, even euphoria, at the fact that she'd been released... that she died in the way that she wanted to, and that she was ready to go, and it was a very peaceful, beautiful death. And I felt a strong intuitive sense, that was due to her practice, that she was able to die well because she'd lived well. She was a very, very loving woman. She'd sort of, take on anybody that walked through the door, you know, a workman, somebody to read the gas meter, she'd start to sort of, you know, take them on and take an interest in their life. She was a very, very loving woman, and she had a meditation practice, and she wasn't frightened of death. And that felt a real example of how to live and how to die, how to let go without holding on. So I felt this huge amount of release of joy. I also felt very strongly in touch with her for certainly the first 3 months. I've never had a problem in believing in rebirth or something continuing after death. And I felt her presence very, very strongly. particularly when I meditated. So in some ways it felt, particularly during those first 3 months, that I was more in contact with her sort of love, than when she was alive, when, you know, all the sort of practicalities of living often so easily get in the way. There was something essential and pure about the experience of that. So I think that was a real privilege. Yeah, to feel that for her and with her. And then the last 9 months or so have been a process of practical things like clearing the house where she lived. And me and my sister have worked together on that. And that's been like, at times, a poignant, sad, but also very beautiful, meaningful experience. My sister's decided she wants to meditate and is learning to meditate, so I've been teaching her meditation. And so we go to my mum's house when we can, and we meditate together. And we've got a little shrine with my mum's photo. And then we do some practical things, and we have lunch, and then we talk, and da-da-da-da. So it's become a sort of extended ritual with some practical things thrown in. And I think it's just been very, very useful for me to really reflect on letting go. I don't let go of things very easily. I get attached easily, even to objects and to the house. And what sort of happens, I mean, those of you who've been bereaved will kind of know this, is that objects that were very, very significant start to just become objects again. You know, I remember a few weeks ago I brought home a vase that I bought my mother, probably when I was a kid, from pocket money, you know, for her birthday. It's just a little thing. And, of course, she treasured it. And, well, what do you do with that? Do you know what I mean? So I brought it home, and, well, I put it on a bookshelf, and it sort of just looked like a little vase again, and not one that I like. And I've got loads of clutter in my room anyway, and it just becomes an object that's no longer meaningful because it's removed from context. That the meaning was in the consciousness of my mother, not in the little vase. So it's been a very interesting kind of... I mean, I knew that as a Buddhist, but I've had to sort of learn that as somebody who's lost a parent, what that feels like for material things to have huge significance, and then the significance just falls through your fingers, and you're left with... stuff.
See, it's interesting because some people would find that a bit depressing and sad. But you're talking about it with quite a lot of. It sounds like you're talking about it quite joyfully, quite.
Yeah. What I mean, it's got its sad aspects to it.
Yeah.
But I do feel. I think what it has made me feel even more is just so grateful. For a Dharmic perspective that says that there is meaning to be found in life, and it's not in the externals, and it's not in form and matter, that there's something beyond form and matter and this human body where real meaning is to be found. And I think my mum's death and how she died and the connection that I felt with her and the fact that I've got a meditation practice that allows me to intuit these things and, you know, a whole, you know, Buddhist context, makes sense of the fact that meaning isn't in these external things. So when I say that objects have just become objects, that's in the context of there is a larger meaning to be found, and it's not in the vase. It's not in the vase. And I felt more in touch with that than ever I have done before, perhaps. And that feels joyous, really, really joyous. Yeah.
So it's like a real increase in faith and
yeah,
Shraddha.
Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, it feels a privilege, to, you know, to have
yeah,
you
yeah.
shared that.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah, no, I'm, glad
yeah.
To.
Yeah.
I'm glad to.
Yeah.
And I do think, well, my Indian conditioning has helped me to open up to the fact that there's something continuing after death. Because I was brought up in a Hindu culture, even though I wasn't ever a practicing Hindu. And in that culture, it's just taken for granted that something continues after death. Of course, in Hindu culture, that becomes rather fixed as an essential self. And Buddhism would say, well, there isn't an essential fixed self, that it's actually just a process that's always changing and flowing. But nevertheless, there is something that continues. And I think my experience has been that if you open up to that, you're more likely to experience the truth of that, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
The eyes that we look with, they colour what we see.
Yeah.
They colour what we see. I can remember saying to Subhuti, who was my preceptor when I was about to be ordained, my father had been dead for... oh, I don't know, a couple of decades by then, a bit more. And I still felt a connection with him. But more than an imaginative connection, I felt his presence, as if he was, sometimes at least, in my life, influencing my life. And I don't mean that in a particularly kind of spooky way, but it was nevertheless not just a psychological way. And I said to Subhuti, this is happening, does that mean I'm a Hindu? And he was saying, well, no, he was completely convinced that death wasn't the end, that our notions of time and space were all not what was real. And he just said, look, if you look at reality with a particular perspective, it will look back at you. With that perspective.
Okay. Well, I like that. So I wanted to ask you about something else. So another, sort of joy I know for you in the last year or so is becoming private preceptor to people.
Yeah.
One of them sitting there, so Dayabhadra last year and then this year Shiradhara. So I wondered if you just... well, tell us what that was like. Mm. Maybe, you know, maybe we might need to say what being a private preceptor is.
Mm.
You could say that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. So you have to cover your ears. Like that, right?
Yeah.
So when somebody's ordained into the Sri Ratna Buddhist order, there are two ordinations that take place. And the first ordination is where... Two parts, thank you. The first part is where the person being ordained is, there's a private ritual with their private preceptor, where their private preceptor witnesses their commitment to living the spiritual life, to going for refuge, to the three jewels. And that private ceremony is... where that person is given their new name, they're given it, as it were, a new identity by that private preceptor. And the private preceptor's job is to just sort of witness that yes, this person really is committing themselves to enlightenment for the sake of all beings, and that they are saying, not only saying that they're able to do that, but the private preceptor sort of knows that they are able to do that because they know the person well enough. So that's the private preceptor's function. And then the other part of the ordination is a more public ceremony where the public preceptor welcomes them into the Sri Ratna Buddhist order. The private ordination, it's as if they've taken this step on their own, sort of regardless of whether anybody else is going to take that step with them. And in the public ceremony, they're welcomed into a whole order of men and women who have also taken that step, and they become fully ordained, and they're given one of these to wear as a symbol of that. So yes, last year I ordained Dayabhadra, and this year Shuddhadhara. What can I say, how it felt?
I think it's another sort of stepping up, isn't it?
Yes, yes it is. It is a stepping up. And I think I had all my usual responses about stepping up, like, no. I mean, I could make them into a more complex, you know, psychologically sophisticated thing, but actually the basic response is kind of no. Thank you. But then there's also a yes, and a yes that feels like a deeper response. And actually kind of doing it felt, well, A, very natural, in that it didn't feel out of keeping with the rest of my life. But what it did feel was a, I don't know if this was your experience, but it felt like a sort of essentialization of what I'm trying to do here at the LBC with my life, at my best moments. So at my best, what I'm trying to do is practice the Dharma and help others practice the Dharma, or at least help to create conditions where others can practice the Dharma. At my best, that's what I'm trying to do. And that feels like the most meaningful thing that I can do with my life. And in the ordination, it feels like, well, it felt like that was all essentialized into a very, very pure form where there is just me and one other person, and we're both trying to do the same thing. And I'm witnessing that person, and in witnessing them, I'm trying to help them and encourage them to also deepen their practice. And that calls forth a deepening in me, etc., etc. So it's this sort of communication that happens, which feels very pure and like an emblem for what I'm trying to do at my best. So it felt natural in that sense, but epitomised. I think the other thing that I became more aware of and felt very grateful for was a sense of lineage. So when I was ordained, you know, I was aware that I was joining this order and that there was this lineage, this spiritual lineage that then I was part of. But I don't think I was that conscious of it. There were so many other things to be conscious of and exciting things like a new name and things that I don't think I was that conscious of it. But ordaining somebody else, I felt very much like I was participating in a lineage that... you know, that is specific to the Trivratna Buddhist order, in that Sangharakshita founded this order, but also goes back all the way to the Buddha through Sangharakshita's teachers, through you know, generations of teachers, all the way back to the Buddha. And I was very, very conscious of the privilege of being part of a tradition, of a lineage. And again, all of that feels... like that's where meaning is to be found.
And you said a few moments ago it called something like it called you to go for refuge more deeply. I was just wondering if you, like, can you tell a difference sort of before and after, as it were? Has it had a lasting effect? Or?
I don't know if it has, actually. I mean, I don't know if it's if it's one thing like that that I can pinpoint that has. I think, but generally my experience has been is that taking responsibility, be it trying to chair the Buddhist Centre or ordain somebody, taking responsibility draws out more from me than I would be willing to give naturally, perhaps. And that then benefits me. I really feel that benefit. It's said, sometimes I think it's said in the Tibetan tradition that the teacher needs the disciple. just as the disciple needs a teacher. And I don't quite know what the Tibetan interpretation of that would be, but for me, I've definitely needed external situations and people, primarily, to ask me to go deeper, because they require me to go deeper, you said to me, and to become bigger. I think also, I guess, from an early stage, I wasn't particularly interested in, I mean, this might sound wrong, and I don't even know if I completely mean it, but I've never particularly been interested in becoming a better person. Oh dear. In the sense that I was relatively happy with the man I was when I came along, and I couldn't quite see the point of lots of hard work to try and become a better man. but when situations and other people need me to be a better person than I am, then I feel a motivation to be. So that helps me. Yeah. That really helps me.
That makes sense. Like something gets activated.
Yeah, something gets activated. Yeah. And I need that. I feel very grateful for that.
So thinking about the LBC as a whole, you're the chairman, so I'm sure you do think about it.
Yeah.
You know, well, my sense, and I know it's yours as well because we've talked about it, is that the centre is really flourishing just now. I mean, just like, you know, here we all are tonight, but there's lots of people coming through the door, there's lots of people, well, throwing themselves very wholeheartedly into things. It feels just very positive, exciting place to be. So, you agree with, you know, I know that you think that as well. So, so what do you think is our next step? So here we are, we've got this kind of happy, healthy situation. Where do we go from here?
Yeah, I was sort of thinking that, because I knew you were going to ask me something like this. And well, I'm very, very pleased, actually, delighted that the centre does seem to be flourishing. And by centre, I mean Sangha, actually. I mean that the Sangha seems to be flourishing. The centres, obviously, those of you who have been around for a few years will know that, you know, it's now a bigger building and a nicer building than it was 3 or 4 years ago. But primarily what's flourishing is, well, the Sangha, us, as it were, you, me. And that feels very, very satisfying and exciting to be part of. But I think the sort of vision for the centre, the vision for the whole Theravada Buddhist community, is would be the same whether it was flourishing or not, in a certain sense. The vision is Sangharakshita's vision of, well, sort of principally, it's the Bodhisattva ideal. The Bodhisattva ideal is an ideal where well, it's a compassionate ideal of spreading the Dharma to the point where all beings become enlightened. And Sangharakshita, when he was in India as a monk, took vows called the Bodhisattva vows, saying that he would dedicate his life for the enlightenment, for the sake of all beings. And the Theravada Buddhist community, I believe, has come out of, it's an expression of his vows. So you could say that the LBC and the LBC Sangha is an expression of Sangharakshita's vows. And from that follows that, you know, we just need to, well, not only practice the Dharma more deeply ourselves, and that's what I hope we see happening, well, it is happening, as more and more individuals do that, but that also we continually try and take the Dharma out to more and more people. Not by sort of badgering them over the head with it, but by offering it very freely, and saying this is possible. This is possible. Meditation can transform your life. Ethics can transform your life. A Buddhist perspective can transform your life for the better. And that message and those practices, perhaps they're more needed well, they've always been needed, but perhaps at this point in time, they're more pertinent and relevant in the West than they've ever been. Because all sorts of traditional views and structures have broken down or are breaking down. And we live in a time where I don't think there is a common value system that people can espouse. You know, I think in this country we've got great values like tolerance and fairness and, you know, increasingly there's a sense of social justice, etc. A long way to go, I know, but there's some great values in our culture here. But nevertheless, sometimes they don't go very much deeper than trying to make sure that there's equal opportunities to make a comfortable material life, if you see what I mean. Not that's a bad thing, that's a hugely good thing, or equal opportunities of education, or whatever it is. That's hugely good. But the Dharma offers something much, much more than that. And I don't think we've got enough of that in our culture. So I think that the centre, whether it's thriving or not, and at the moment it is, the work of the centre involves both us trying to deepen and then us trying to go out as a sangha to include more and more people. And actually the two are two sides of the same thing, because we couldn't just, if you were deepening your practice, there is naturally an impulse to share the fruits of your practice. And if you were just trying to go out without deepening, then it doesn't work. It just becomes, at best it becomes sort of good-natured social work kind of thing. Or at worst, we just make it become hypocritical if we're not practicing and saying, you know, you should meditate or something. So the vision for the centre is very much one of trying to deepen and extend what we've got here. And that is in line with Bhante's Bodhisattva vows. I think in more concrete terms, if I can talk more concretely, yeah. I think what I'd like to see is, in a way, more and more people able to take their Dharma practice into all aspects of their life. So I've been fortunate enough to live in a community with other Buddhists and to work here at the centre with other Buddhists. Not everybody is going to be able to do that, or perhaps even wants to do that. But nevertheless, we can all try and integrate Buddhism and Buddhist values and practice into our working life, into our home life, into our family life, into whatever aspects of our life there are. Because for Buddhism to really become transformative, it has to permeate all aspects of our being. So really I'd like to see more people doing that in whatever ways they can. I know some people are trying to create new working contexts where, you know, they can work together with other Buddhists in like livelihood. We've had in the last 2 years at least two new communities form, that's fantastic for those that want to live communally. But there might be other ways also of coming together and making Buddhism more and more part of all aspects of our life. So I'd really like to see that happen more and more. Not that it isn't happening, but I'd like to see it happen more and more. I'm really, really delighted that over the last 2 years particularly, some younger people have got together and started this Sub-35 initiative, which I think has brought in so many people that wouldn't have necessarily felt comfortable walking into the Buddhist Centre before, because they would have been surrounded by people much older than themselves. Yeah. Whereas now, look around, and it's not unusual to be relatively young and be practicing at the centre. And I think that's just, a tremendous boon for all of us now, because I think we need that energy and that dynamism and enthusiasm. But also it's really, really important for the future of the Sangha. So when you and I finally have just retired and I can lie around drinking coffee with a clear conscience, it's really, really important that somebody steps in. So I'm delighted that there are, with that initiative. But I'd also like to see younger people still. Like, we don't attract very many teenagers, and you've been pointing this out very much, and I'd like to see something of that happen. When I was in my teens, I thought of myself as a Buddhist. And by the time I was 19, I was trying to look for a Buddhist group and didn't really find something. But I had a genuine spiritual aspiration, which, if it had been met by something like Tri Ratna and the LBC, I would have started practicing much earlier than I did. It took me another 10 years to find this place. So I think there are a lot of younger people still to whom we've got something to offer. So that's something else that I'd like to see. We're doing all this fundraising. Well, you're doing the fundraising. for this retreat centre, for Jara, to improve, to enhance, to make more beautiful our retreat centre and allow more people to go on retreat. And that's actually a really, really vital step for so many people, isn't it, to go on retreat. For me, it was the thing that turned me from just being an enthusiastic attender once a week at the centre to somebody that really wanted to get more involved. It was my first retreat that enabled that to happen, that sort of propelled that. And I'd really, really like to see a retreat centre where more and more people can go on retreat. This is the London Buddhist Centre, yes. And yet we only have a retreat centre for, 35 people. And actually, look at how many people, are here just tonight. There are 300 people on this urban retreat. And we need somewhere where more people can go on retreat more of the time. That feels a really essential thing to help people experience what the Dharma is all about. So I'd like to see a retreat centre that was worthy of the LBC. Vajrasana is very beautiful, but it's not adequate. So I'd like to see that happen in the next few years. I'd also like to see, our breathing space work is work which really does, it's tiny in a way, but it starts to help people in the local community who aren't necessarily interested in Buddhism. And I think it's really important that we have some work that is about the local community and not just about trying to offer Buddhism. So, for example, at the moment, we've got a carer's retreat at Vajrasana. And at times on our carer's retreats, we've had Bangladeshi people go, Muslims go. And they'd never really want to walk into a Buddhist centre and, hear about the Dharma. But they do want to learn to meditate in order to better manage their lives. And some of them have very, very hard lives as carers. And we live in a community where there's a significant Bangladeshi population. I'd like to see if we can offer something to more people without them expecting that there's a sort of Buddhist string attached. Or whatever. I think we can do more of that sort of outreach work. I know there's plans afoot to start teaching meditation for stress relief in some of the estates around here. Again, people who might not ever walk through the doors of the centre, they wouldn't see themselves as walking through the LBC. But if you in a community hall were teaching relaxation and stress management, they might do. So I'd like to see more of that sort of outreach work happen. Yeah. And then I think there's something about the wider world, the culture that we live in, needing to hear about Buddhist values. You know, just this last week we've had rioting going on in so many Islamic countries, people dying because of this offensive film that's been made in America. And it's a sort of madness on both sides. It's a sort of madness that seems to easily take over. You know, a couple of summers ago, I mean, we've just had the Olympics and this glorious sort of feel-good few weeks. But, you know, the summer before, there was rioting on the streets. I can remember a phone call. I was on retreat and a phone call from Prasanna Vera saying, you know, Roman Road is a scene of some potential rioting. Tesco's was looted, etc. So we live in this kind of very precarious culture. You know, it's been a year since the Occupy movement. And I was just reading today, well, what's happened to the Occupy movement? The press are no longer interested. Some people are still, you know, camping out in America and elsewhere. But the press, you know, it's yesterday's news now. But those people were trying to do something radical and point to cultural values that weren't right and aren't working. Well, Buddhism has something to say about how we're living as a society, how we're living collectively. And the LBC is a tiny, tiny kind of institution. But I think we've got something really important to offer, more than our size would somehow imply. And I hope that we can start to have a voice, more of a voice, in wider culture. And that doesn't mean just me as chairman. I'm not even, I think, very well suited to this. I think it means all of us, in our lives and whatever spheres of influence we have, trying to both exemplify but also communicate Buddhist values, again, without trying to bash people over the heads with them, but because there's something really sensible here and something that's human, of human importance, regardless of, you know, what you call yourself in terms of religion. Yeah. So that's a bit of the more sort of concrete aspects of how I think we can really build on the centre that's flourishing, the sangha that's flourishing. Mm. I mean, I'm delighted that, you know, this urban retreat is now, it's well established in our calendar. It's the largest event that happens. Mm. 300 people, just for a week, trying to focus more on their practice. That's just fantastic. Yeah. That's just fantastic. Yeah. But it could be 500, couldn't it?
Yeah.
It could be. You know, it could be more. And London is vast, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'd like to see. And I think, you know, not everything's going to happen in this building. Mm. This building's not big enough. But we can start reaching out. So I'm very excited that we're going to start. There's a project starting soon in South London, in Balham. Which is an outreach project from the LBC. Yeah. And who knows, in time, that might actually seed a new Buddhist centre in Balham. And we could do more of that.
Yeah.
And I think, in a way, there's always sort of bottlenecks in resources, but mostly what we need is more people doing that.
Yeah.
And that means us. Yeah. That means us willing to, as I say, take our own practice deeper and to try and take our practice out.
Thank you. Gosh, it's once inspiring to have the vision spelled out so clearly. Mm. Yeah. Well, 21:42. So I think we're going to wind up here. So, thanks very much, Niana Bhatia.
Thank you.
Really, really. Thank you. Very much enjoyed it.